Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Shavuos Daf Chof Tes. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a specially marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage and then go to option 2. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief formatted introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. We begin today's shiur at the new Mishnah that you will notice 8 lines from the top of Daf Chof Tes. On the side of the Gemara, you will notice a Nosei Mivneh heading, Nosei the topic heading, Mivneh structural note, where a diamond is featured, and that is used in the Mishnah to highlight the word Nishba. Dugmois shel shvuas shov. We'll see different examples of a shvua, an oath that is considered in vain. The double underline marking that you'll see are hagdoros shel mahi shvuas shov. Categories, definitions of what kind of oath would be considered an oath in vain. We've noted in the past that it's important to know how to categorize different kinds of oaths because the violation of the oath, depending on what kind of oath it is, carries a different type of penalty. So now the Mishnah. Ezo hi shvuas shov. What is considered such an oath, an oath in vain? Nishba l'shanois es yadua l'adam. A person who swears claiming something is different than that which everyone knows it to be. For example, Omar al ha'amud shel even shehu shel zav. Person claims that a stone pillar is made of gold. V'al ho'ish shehu isha. He swears regarding a man, a male, that it is a female. V'al ho'isha shehi ish. Or he swears regarding a woman that it's a man. A second example or category of shvuas shov. Nishba al dovor she'ef shelo. A person swears concerning something that cannot be. Im lo ro'isi gomol she'porech ba'avir. He swears concerning, and here I'm going to be deliberately vague because we're going to wait till we get to the Gemara where the Gemara focuses on how to translate this line, but he swears concerning something related to a flying camel in the air, that is. Camels do not fly through the air, and he swears concerning such an entity. V'in lo ro'isi nochosh kikiras beis habad. Or he swears concerning having seen a snake like the beam of an olive press. Omar li'edim bo v'hayiduni. Here we have something that's not a function of a change in reality, but nevertheless, it's something that is we call e'efsher, that cannot be, and we're going to be referring here to the voidance, the annulment of a mitzvah. For example, a person says to witnesses, bo v'hayiduni, I know that you know information that could serve on my behalf if you were to testify for me in court. And then they react, shvua shelo na'idach. They swear that we are not going to testify on your behalf. Now, one is obligated, if he knows information that's beneficial to someone, to come and testify on their behalf. Not doing so, swearing not to do so, is in effect swearing to mevatel a mitzvah, to void a mitzvah. And that's how Rashi presents this in a different context, but that's actually right over here on the first Rashi of the Mishnah, on the second narrow line, Rashi says, Shvu shaloni idach bitol mitzvahu. Hainu Dover Shievsha, to void, to try to cancel a mitzvah, is something that is cannot be. In other words, it is not to be done. Therefore, you are swearing to do something that should not be done. That falls in the category of a shvuas shov. Third category, nishba levatel es hamitzvah. Here, it's interesting that the Mishnah presents this as a whole category, when in fact shvuas shlo ne'idach was, as Rashi says, a bittul mitzvah. But here we have more examples. Shelo la'aso sukkah, shelo litol lulav, v'shelo lo niach tefillin. Person swears not to make a sukkah, not to perform the mitzvah of lulav, nor to don tefillin. Zuhi shvuas shov shechayov malzdoina makis val shigigasa poter. This is what we mean when we refer to a shvuas shov, the result of which, if one violates it willingly, he is subject to lashing. If unwittingly, he is exempt. Exempt, no sacrifice is brought. This is in contrast with the shvuas bitui that we have seen in the past. Shvua she'ochal kikarzu, shvua shelo ochlena. Man utters two oaths. First oath, he swears he's going to eat this loaf. And he says then a second shvua, that he is not going to eat that loaf. Horishonah shvuas bitui. The first oath is called a shvuas bitui. It's an oath of utterance. He swore that he's going to eat the bread. So he's expected to fulfill that oath and eat the bread. Vashnia shvuas shov. The second oath that came on the heels of the first one in this case is a shvuas shov, because he is swearing not to fulfill something he is obligated to do by virtue of an oath. That's a mitzvah. You are commanded to fulfill your shvua. And now your second shvua is a mitzvah, was a shvua to counter the fulfillment of an oath. We saw before that that is a shvuas shov. Ochlo, if he then eats that loaf, ovar al shvuas shov, he has violated the shvuas shov. What was the shvuas shov? Not to eat it. Well, he went and ate it, so he had violated that particular shvua. Lo ochla ovar al shvuas bitui. If he doesn't eat it, that's in violation of the first shvua. And now we turn to the Gemara. But before we learn the Gemara itself, we look at the side where we have a nosei, topic heading, Machlokes Abaye and Rava, Begirsas HaMishnah. Our introduction is referring to the section of Gemara that follows the first three opening lines, so we'll get back to this topic heading in a moment. We learn the Gemara, Omar Ula, Vahu Shenikru L'Shloisha B'nei Adam. When the Mishnah says L'Shano Yisus Yodu L'Bnei Adam, he would have to be swearing concerning something that was already recognized by three people. If you try to, if you swear counter to what is known as a fact by three people, you are guilty of a shvuas shov. If it's not known by three people, so then your oath that counters reality, but it's a reality that's not known by three, that's called a shvuas sheker, an oath of a lie. Nishba al dover shi efshir, al dover shi efshilo, im lo ro'isi gomol haporeach bavir. So now, in terms of the Mishnah and the translation, if we take the literal root, you would say he swore concerning something that cannot be. And what was his oath? He swore that he, im lo ro'isi, was he did not see a flying camel. Well, what's the problem with that? That sounds pretty accurate. Sounds like a true statement. I didn't see a flying camel. You're never going to see a flying camel. So how is this a description of a Shvuah Shav? The Gemara points this language problem out. Shvuah Sheroisi Lo Komar. It doesn't say in the Mishnah as a description of a Shvuah Shav, someone swears, I saw a flying camel. My im lo roisi, what is meant by this phrase that's in the negative? Abaye Omar Tani Shvuah Sheroisi. Abaye says that the text of the Mishnah should be slightly changed, and it should read as Shvuah Sheroisi, I swear that I saw a camel flying through the air. And that would be a Shvuah Shav. Rav Omar, Rav says, no, keep the language of the Mishnah as it is. But Omer, we're talking about someone who says the following. Yesu kol peros ha'olam. Kol peros ha'olam alai. Let all the fruits of the world be forbidden to me. Im lo ro'isi gomel ha'perach bi'avir. If I didn't see a flying camel. Well, the result of this is that this man has now forbidden himself to all the peros of the world. Because he, in fact, did not see a flying camel. Now, a person doesn't want to forbid himself from all the fruit in the world. Tosfos points out, in the Dibur Masul of Tosfos Ba'oimer, he says, this is a Shvuah Shav, because this is something that a person cannot possibly endure. The person had declared that, let all the fruits of the world be prohibited to me as a shvua. In other words, the eating of any of the fruits of the world would be for me a violation of this oath. If I did not see a flying camel. We continue now in the Gemara. Omar le Ravino le Ravashi. Note that we have a long question, and we also have a house marking that's going to appear in an alternating direction. And on the side of the Gemara, under the Nosei Mivne heading, you have the house, and we call this a ma'akav, an attempt to keep track of the give-and-take style of the Gemara. With the point facing upwards, that this will represent shelos, questions. The inverted house will represent tshuvos, responses. Sukya zu mivareres, the Gemara at hand clarifies ha dikatoni gomel perer bavir. The Mishnah said that a flying camel through the air umagdiro kedover sheino and classifies that as something that cannot be umishum kach nechshav shvuah shav, and because it's something that cannot be, it's called a shvuah shav. Lama lo amrina de adam zeh ra oif gadol. Why not say that what happened here is this person saw a large bird that was flying through the air? Umechaneu gomel poreach bavir, and he calls it by this term. He invents a term to refer to a very large flying bird. The aldas atzmo hu nishba, and the oath was with his own definitions of things, ubekushto mishtaba, and he swore an honest oath. So here we're describing someone that calls very large birds flying camels, so that when he swears that he saw a flying camel, it's not a vain oath. He's swearing about something that he really saw. He simply defines large birds by using the term gomel poreach, flying camel. So the question then is, why can't we simply say that? And as the Gemara goes on, there will be responses to it. As we indicated, the inverted house shows that. Notice that we have a long question. Omar le Ravino le Ravashi. Vidilma hai gavra. Maybe the man that swore that he is ossering, he's preventing, he's prohibiting Peros Ha'olam if he did not see a large camel flying in the air, Sipoira Rabba Chazi, he saw a large bird, the Asik Le Shmo Gamlo, and he calls it a camel. The Chiko Mishtaba, and when he swears, Adaita Dide Mishtaba, he swore with that in mind. So that the oath that he took is an honest to goodness truth. So he had said, let us say, using Rava's example, let all the peros of the world be usher to me if I did not see. But if he did see, then the peros won't be usher. He saw a large bird. The chitema boser pume azlinon velo azlinon boser daite. You might argue that, what do you mean we're going to take into consider what he thinks? We follow pume. Boser Pume means we follow what he says, not that which he's thinking. But that's not true. For Hotanya, we have the following source, which has to do with a shvua that's imposed by judges. Someone who is obligated to swear, and he is the oath is imposed upon him by the court. The source says, Kishimashpia noisoi, when we impose the oath on someone who is duty-bound to swear, Omrim lo, we inform him. Heveyodea, shelo al daitcho, onu mashbien oischa. The oath that we're imposing you is not an oath based on how you interpret things. Elo al datenu valdas beisdin. It's the way we explain things and the way the court understands things. In simple terms, the shvua that we're imposing upon you is with the simple popular understanding of the words and not based on your internal personal interpretations. My taima, why is it that the court goes out of its way to say all of this? Lav mishum damrinon, is it not so because dilmo is gundri yohivle? Maybe a person had we'll talk about a case of a loan where a person claims that he paid back part of a loan after the lender is claiming you owe me money, so the borrower acknowledges partial payment. That's called moida b'mikzas, and when someone is moida b'mikzas, when he responds with a partial acknowledgement, he has to swear. So and he claims that he paid back part of the loan. So what we're fearful of is that he may have given him plastic chips, iskundri, little chips. And of course, maybe in the time of the Gemara, they weren't made of plastic. They were wood chips. And the asik lehu shmozuzi, and he calls them coins. It's like someone paying back his loan with Monopoly money. The borrower gave the lender half the loan, $100 loan, and he gave him a $50 bill from Monopoly. When he would swear otherwise without the court announcement, people do swear with their own interpretations in mind. And in order to forestall this possibility, the court makes its announcement. So outside the realm of court-imposed oaths, what do we see from here? We see that people on their own will swear according to their own interpretations. So that is what we're raising here as a question on why are we saying that someone who spoke about the flying camel, according to Abaye, he swore that he saw a flying camel. He's not lying. He's swearing according to his own personal interpretations and definitions of what a flying camel is, namely a large bird. Loi. From the case here with the court and its announcement, that's not what we are taking into consideration. Hosom, in the case of the Shvuos HaDayonim, Mishum Kanya de Rava. It's because of the case of the cane, the Kanya cane, a hollow tube, which people might use as a walking cane, that happened in the case of Rava. In that case, the lender received from the borrower, in other words, the borrower, when he said he paid back half the loan, he had actually given to the lender coins. We'll explain the whole story in a moment, but what the Shavuos HaDayanim source represents, this court-imposed oath case where the court made its announcement with its disclaimer, that wasn't because of the fear of personal interpretations of explaining an item as one thing when it's really something else, but rather it's because of the actual item itself, but done under subterfuge circumstances. Now let's explain the actual story. The case that's referred to as Kanya Derava is a lender was claiming $100 from the borrower, and the borrower said, "You know, I paid you $50." And they say, "Well, you know, if you're acknowledging partial payment, the law is you have to swear to that effect. You have to swear that you paid $50 and that you owe only $50 more." So the borrower had come to court with a cane that was filled with coins. The amount of coins, $50 worth of coins, stuffed into the cane. So it's actual money, it's real money, not monopoly money and not tiddlywinks. The borrower, before swearing, he said to the lender, he said, "Would you mind holding this cane for me? Take this." He says, "Take this," the cane filled with the coins. The borrower then swore, "I gave him $50. Well, that's true. He did give him $50. There were $50 of coins stuffed into that cane, into that hollow walking stick. The lender became so irate because, as far as he was concerned, he got nothing from this guy's now swearing, which in his eyes, a lie. He took the cane and he smashed it on the ground. And lo and behold, all the coins rolled out. So the court, after that incident, the court, or the halacha, I should say, says, you know, when you swear, you better swear according to our understanding of things, that payments are made not with money stuffed in canes, but payments are made to people that you owe money to in an open, straight-out fashion. So the disclaimer of lo al daitcha anu mashbiroscha is not because of reinterpreting something that's one thing when it really is something else, but it's really a disclaimer so as to prevent people from practicing this type of subterfuge. The Gemara continues with a long question again. Toshma v'chein motzinu. We find likely this concept of a disclaimer. Kishishbia Moshe es Yisrael, when at the time of the receipt of the Torah, the leader of the people, the Jewish people, that's Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, he imposed an oath upon them, and he said, Amar Lehem, in anticipation of their accepting of the Torah, he said, "Du shelo al daitchem ani mashbiaschem elo al das hamokoim val daati." I am imposing the oath of acceptance of Torah on you, not according to your interpretation of things, not according to your mindset, but according to the mindset of the Almighty and my mindset. V'amai leim alahu. Why does Moshe Rabbeinu have to say all of that? Why doesn't he simply say, "Kaimu mai do'omar eloka"? Fulfill that which the Almighty expects of you. So why did he not say that? Lav mishum demaski adaitayu avodas kechavim. Had Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Kaimu mai de Omar Eloika," they would have sworn that they are going to fulfill the will of an idol. In other words, that they'll take the word Eloka and interpret it in their minds as referring to an idol. The Rashi, halfway down the page, says, Lav mishum demaskia daitu avos kechavim umaskule shmo Eloka. They have in mind, when they would have accepted that rule of kaimu mai domar aloka, that we're the people, we're accepting the words of an idol, and we're interpreting that an idol is also called by that word. Lo. The Gemara says that's not what Moshe Rabbeinu was fearful of. Words, if that's what he was fearful of, then we would see that we do consider the possibility that people reinterpret things in their own mind and say it's one thing when in reality it's something else. But that's not really the case. Why then did Moshe Rabbeinu, when he wanted to bind the Jewish people to accepting the Torah, why did he avoid this suggestion of Kaimu Mai Domar Loka? Mishum da avoidas kechovim nami ikri Eloiha. The problem with that would have been that idols are referred to by the Torah itself using that word. Dichtiv Elohei Chesev Elohei Zov. The Torah says in Parshas Yisro that you shall not make for yourselves images of silver and gold that are for idolatrous purposes. So that you see that word, Eloha, means actually an idol. Of course, you have to understand in what context you use the word. But that word itself can refer directly to an idol. It's not a function of a reinterpretation. It's a function of their decision in what Eloha should refer to. So Moshe Rabbeinu avoided saying Kaimu Mai Do'omar Eloika, because they could have sworn thusly, and in their minds they're swearing an absolute truth, an objective absolute truth. The Gemara asks, "V'leim olahu?" Why doesn't Moshe Rabbeinu? And you'll notice in the next few lines a flurry of these house markings in an alternating direction as we continue with our series of questions. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu specifically say "lo al daitchem" and "lo al das hamok val dati" when he could have said something else? Is it? And each time we're going to be suggesting the fact that he avoided saying one of these other suggestions is because that would have enabled them to reinterpret it to refer to something else. And each time we do that, we're reinstating the basic question here, which always reflects back to the person who swore about the flying camel. Maybe he in fact was telling the truth in his own mind. The Gemara asks, "V'leimo lehu kaimu Torah." Why did Moshe Rabbeinu not say, "Fulfill the Torah"? Obligate them under oath that they are now accepting the Torah. So is it not so that he avoided saying that because they would interpret sins in their own mind and say that sins are called Torah? The Rashi, let's read it together. V'leim alohu kaimu Torah v'yashbiyam alkach, and bind them using that type of oath. Lav mishum, is it not so that he avoided saying kaimu Torah demaski adatayu averos, that when they're accepting upon themselves Torah, they're saying, we're going to do sins. V'koru lahu Torah. And they call sins in their own minds by the word Torah. U'mishtabi adatayu. And with sins in mind, that is what they're swearing to fulfill. The Gemara responds, no, that's not why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't bind them by an oath of Kaimu Torah, but rather, at the Gemara, last narrow line of the Gemara, inverted house, Kada Torah. It simply would have been an insufficient type of oath, because Kaimu Torah is in the singular, and we have not only a written Torah, we have an oral tradition as well. We call the Torah Shebaal Peh. And had he bound them to Kaimu Torah, that they would have said, well, we're duty bound to keep only one of those Torahs. For example, we're going to keep only the words of the Torah Shebiksav, the written Torah, which of course is not a Jewish way of life. There are those that keep one Torah, the Tzedukim, the original apostates who abandoned the oral tradition. So, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want them to have an opportunity to bind themselves to only one Torah. That's why he didn't say Kaimu Torah, not because of the fear of people swearing with a reinterpretation of reality in their mind. Question: Velema, why doesn't he then? Why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu simply say Kaimu Shtei Toros? If the whole problem with Kaimu Torah was the idea of one Torah, so he could have bound them to the vow of keep the two Torahs. The Gemara says no. The reason that wouldn't have been effective is because that too could have truthfully meant something else. Torah, chatos, osham, the laws of sacrifices are referred to as Torah, chatos, the laws of sin offerings, the laws of osham, guilt offerings. So you have the word toros in the plural, but referring to a very limited area of law. So that would not have been an effective expression to bind them for the acceptance of all of the Torah. The Gemara says, if that's the case, then Kaimu Kol HaTorah Kula. Could Moshe Rabbeinu not have used that expression? Keep the entire Torah. The Gemara says, no, that wouldn't have bound them to all of the mitzvahs of the Torah. Avodas Kechavim, all that would have meant in their minds, again, is a truthful interpretation of the words of the Kaimu Kol HaTorah Kula, is referring to idolatry. Now, how does idolatry correspond to the expression Kol HaTorah Kula? The Yom HaMor, it has been taught. Chamura Avodas Kechavim Shekol HaKofer Bo, sin of idolatry is so severe that we explain that he who denies it, kemoide b'chol ha-Torah kula, it's tantamount to someone accepting all of the Torah. It might be that this entire phrase is a euphemism, and if it is, so it would mean that avodah zorah, idolatry, is such a severe offense that anyone who accepts idolatry is like someone who denies the entire Torah. Whichever way, the word all of the Torah could be a truthful reference to idolatry. So that if he was binding them to keep the entire Torah, all they would have been bound to is the observance of the laws prohibiting idolatry. So the Gemara asks, V'leimo lehu kaimu mitzvah. Why couldn't Moshe Rabbeinu have said, fulfill mitzvah? And not use the word Torah, but use the word fulfill mitzvah. The Gemara says, well, that wouldn't have been effective in binding them to observing all of the Torah. Chada mitzvah, that's in the singular. Question, why couldn't he have said to them, mitzvos, fulfill the mitzvos? The Gemara says, good, the word mitzvos is in the plural, tarfi, but all that would have been a reference to is two mitzvos. Question, kol ha-mitzvos kulon, why couldn't Moshe Rabbeinu have bound the people to keep all of the mitzvos? The Gemara says, mitzvah tzitzis, telling people keep all of the mitzvos, would have bound them to keeping the laws of tzitzis. The Omar Ma'ar, shkula mitzvah tzitzis, keneged kol ha-mitzvos kulon. The mitzvah of tzitzis is equal in, we'll say, in merit to fulfilling all of the mitzvahs of the Torah. Question: V'leim alahu, why couldn't Moshe Rabbeinu have said to them, "Kaimu sheish meis shloish esrei mitzvos"? Keep all 613 mitzvahs. So, if this was an option and he didn't use it, would this not reinstate our original question that he had to use the expression of "De'u shelo al daitchem ani mashbiaschem el al das amok val dati"? Because otherwise, people would have reinterpreted things to refer to something else. The Gemara responds, "Litamech, according to you, that you want to say that he said lo al daitchem in order to keep them from reinterpreting things into their own terms, in other words, saying something that's not an objective reality and claiming it to be what they had in mind. So, lema lahu al dati. Wouldn't it have been sufficient for him to say, I'm lo al daitchem, rather al dati, al das hamokoim lomali? Why did he have to say in the original oath that he imposed on them that as well? With the that you're swearing with the approval or with the mind of the Almighty. Let's take a look at Rashi, just a few lines from the bottom. Ulitamech, according to you, deboyes lemeimar, that you're trying to say dahai diamrina luhu, that which Moshe Rabbeinu had said, lo al datchem, that I'm binding you, but not according to your mindset. Ki hechi delo liski adai tayu mai debo, umaski le hai shmo, that was really to prevent them from saying, accepting an oath, but on their own terms, with their own interpretation of things. If that is all that Moshe Rabbeinu was concerned with, so then wouldn't it have been sufficient for him to say to them, I'm binding you by oath according to my mindset, thereby precluding or preventing them from this reinterpretation possibility? Why then did Moshe Rabbeinu add al-das hamokoyim in his disclaimer to them? The Gemara continues at the top of Amud Beis. Ela ki hechi delo teve hafora l'shvuasayu. The disclaimer that Moshe Rabbeinu said to them was not in order to forestall their swearing based on their own personal interpretation of things, but rather it was to create a type of oath that has no annulment to it. There are rules concerning when and when not annulment can take place. One of the rules that governs annulment of vows is an annulment that is done with the knowledge of the of the public, we'll say, of the masses, or of the knowledge of others. That's called a neder. That's a neder or shvua. That's al das rabim. A neder or shvua. That's al das rabim. Ein lo hafora, cannot be rescinded. It cannot be annulled. So Rashi at the top. Elo hochi komer lahu lo al daitchem. I am binding you by this oath to accept the Torah not on you, with your mindset. Ki heichi deteve shvaschem al das achirim. Your oath is now not according to your own mindset, but it's with the mindset of others. Velo yuchlu heim lahatira, and as a result of that, it cannot be undone. The neder shehudar al das rabim ein lo hafara. So it would seem that that Moshe Rabbeinu was including not only himself. You're swearing not only with mindset, but with the mindset of the Almighty, representing the mindset of the others, the Rabbim, so that it has no possible retraction or annulment. So as we look over this entire sukkah, we had marked it very carefully, showing all of the back and forth discussion, and therefore the problem behind the oath or the shvua of Gomel Porech Ba'avir is what we call a shvuas shov. It's a vain shvua, and it has no connection anymore as a result of this discussion to a person swearing a true shvua and its truthfulness based on a person's own personal reinterpretation of things. That's not something that we take into consideration. So we continue. V'im lo ra'isi nochosh kikuras beis habad. This was an example of a shvuas shav, something that simply does not exist. And what was he saying then? Of course, you have Abaye's version or Rava's version, but he was, if you take Abaye's version, he was saying, he swore that he saw a serpent like the beam of an olive press. The beam of an olive press is a very large, thick entity. So the Mishnah then is telling us that snakes that are that size don't exist. The Gemara asks, "Velo, is that so that they don't exist?" Vahu, the Hava b'shnei shover makla. There was a snake that was in the years of Shover Malka, the king of Persia, was referred to as Shover Malka. Havechad, the achsik tleisar urvisotivna. There was one that was so large it was threatening the population, and they fed it 13 horse stalls full of straw. And Rashi tells a little more of the story, and they hid some burning coals in the straw. It swallowed this massive amount and eventually died as a result of the fire that raged within it. So what do we see? We see that this, snakes can be very, very large. The Gemara says, Omar Shmuel, the fact that snakes can be very large, yes, we acknowledge that as reality, and in that respect, snakes in fact can be like a Kiras Beis Habad. But when the Mishnah said that a Nochash Kikuras Beis Habad doesn't exist, it's with regard to another aspect of a Kuras Beis Habad. A Kuras Beis Habad, a beam of an olive press, was notched. And snakes that have notches in them, notches or possibly scales, they don't exist. The Gemara asks, what do you mean snakes that are toruf don't exist? Kulunami mitruf trifin. All snakes have notches in them. Rashi, across from here, explains the word betoruf. Hodokomar, cursed beis habad, that which the Mishnah said, cursed beis habad, and snakes don't exist like that, and hence teshua shav sheish bo charitzin. The cursed beis habad has notches in it. Kach ro'isi nochosh menumar. Thus the person would be swearing that I saw a snake that was menumor. Menumor usually means spotted, but let's assume that it means spotted with notches in it. The Gemara, though, asks, but all snakes are like that. The Gemara answers, b'shegaboi toruf. It's true that snakes have this phenomenon of being toruf, say notched or scaly. That is true when you're looking at it on its neck, but not along its entire back. The Rashi says, Kulu nami mitrif trifi. Umeshani, Rashi says, b'shegaboi toruf nishpa. When he swore the oath that we say is in vain is when its back is described as toruf. Shehoya toruf begabo. V'ein nochosh osui b'char b'bruos ela b'grono. This phenomenon of toruf, I know we translate it, and many times you notice that if you're a veteran listener of Gemara Markings, Daf Yomi Shurim, you know that we oftentimes hesitate in translating many expressions, because it could be that which the Gemara is referring to is not necessarily in accordance with our strict translation. Here is a case in point where depending on how you explain toruf and depending on how you refer to a nochosh, the reality will exist. But for our purposes, what the Gemara is saying is that without resorting to simple translation, the case of a shvuas shav is a nochosh who's described as this person who was swearing. He was describing a nochosh whose entire gav, his entire back, was toruf. And that doesn't exist. It's true that all nochoshas are toruf, but that's only begrono, as we saw in the Rashi, in its throat area, not the entire body. Shvua she'ochal kikar zu, shvua she'lo ochlena. The Mishnah describes someone who made two oaths. One oath was to eat the loaf, and the second oath, he swore not to eat the loaf. The Mishnah went on and said, Lo achla, if he doesn't eat it, then ovro al shuas bitui. Now, that means that according to this scenario, the non-eating of it would be a violation of shuas bitui, which sounds like he's in violation of only one offense. He made these two oaths. If he doesn't eat it, he's then in violation of only one. The original oath was what? To eat it. If he doesn't eat it, so he's in violation of the original oath, which was to eat it. That was a shuas bitui, an oath of utterance. The Gemara, though, asks, this fellow who made these two oaths, are you saying he's in violation of only one? Hashto mishum shuas bitui mechayev, mishum shuas shav lo mechayev, hare yotzeso shvua l'shav. This fellow who made these two oaths, the second oath was an oath in vain. It was an oath to not fulfill, was to void the self-imposed mitzvah, the self-imposed obligation. His original oath was what? He swore to eat the loaf. How can you then swear not to eat it? Well, he did. He swore not to eat it. That's a shvuas shav. So why do you say that this person, if he doesn't eat the loaf, he's in violation of only a shvuas bitui? The Gemara answers, you're right. Omar Rav Yirmiya Tani af shvuas bitui. He's in violation even of a shvuas bitui. Certainly he's in violation of the shvuas shav. As soon as that shvua came out of his mouth, he was already in violation of swearing a shvua in vain. And by not eating that loaf, in fact, he's also over, he's also in violation of a shvuas bitui. we have a new Mishnah, and you notice the double underlining scheme of marking on the side of the Gemara. And by the way, if you don't have a marked Gemara, you can access them by contacting gmarkings@gmail.com. The Nosei Mivneh heading highlights the double underline, Shvuas Bitui and Shvuas Shav. HaMishnah Roshemes Protim HaNoigim L'Shvuas Elu. The Mishnah will then detail points that are relevant to these two kinds of Shvuas. You also see the diamond being used to highlight Havlotas, the word Atzmo, and Achirim. Atzmo meaning himself, Achirim meaning others. Now the Mishnah. Shvuas Bitui Noheges, a vow or an oath of utterance is something that applies by noshim with noshim, bekroivim with rechokim, men, women, relatives, non-relatives, b'ksherim with b'sulim, people that are fit to testify, people that are unfit to testify, b'fnei beizdin, v'shelo b'fnei beizdin, whether the oath is made in a court or outside a court, mi pi atzmo. These are all situations of an oath when he vows it on his own, when he himself initiates the vow. Mi pi atzmo, he vowed thusly. V'chayovin al zdoina makis v'al shigigosa korban oyla v'yored. And if one willingly violates a shvuas bitui, he's liable to receive lashing. And if he violated it unwittingly, he is obligated to bring a sin offering whose price can fluctuate depending on the person's level of wealth. Oyla means it goes up in expense. He had to bring an animal sin offering if he's a man of means, and he can get away with a bird offering, v'yored. V'yored means it goes down if he is a man that is not of means. It's pointed out that all of the details that you see here regarding the Shvuas Bitui, it applies to women as well, it applies to people that are relatives as well, relatives to one another. These details are actually quite obvious when it comes to Shvuas Bitui, but they're taught here really as a point of contrast to that which we see at the beginning of the next perek regarding Shvuas Ha'edus. This is the oath that we impose on witnesses who claim that they don't know testimony. We impose an oath on them that they are telling the truth. That's Shvuas Ha'edus. And there, that oath is limited with regard to whom it applies. It applies only to those that are fit to testify, and also place becomes a factor. It's a vow that's imposed in court, possibly. That's where testimony takes place. So in contrast with the Shvuas Ha'edus, the Mishnah here teaches a lot of details which really, in and of themselves, might be fairly obvious. And I will see the same thing with regard to a Shvuas Shav. And we hence continue in the mission with our Roman numeral number 2. Shvuas Shav Noheges, the vain Shvua, is a factor, is binding, is a person can be guilty of it. Be'anoshim with anoshim, be'rechoikim with ekroivim, be'ksherim with besulim, be'fnei beizdin, v'shelo be'fnei beizdin, umi pi atzmo. Note, the only point of difference here is the shogeg level of violation. Here, in the case of a shvuas shav, when he violates it, b'shogeg, he is exempt from bringing a sacrifice. The Torah features the obligation of bringing a sacrifice in the case of a shvuas bitui, not in the case of a shvuas shav. Achazu v'achazu hamushpo mipi achirim chayav. Whether a shvuas bitui or a shvuas shav, if the vow is imposed upon him by others, it also is binding. Ketzad. What's an example of that? Omar lo achalti hayom. V'lo hinachti tefillin hayom. The example of lo achalti would be an example of a shvuas bitui. A person claims, I did not eat today. Or he claims, I did not put on tefillin today. Tefillin is in the realm of mitzvah, so it could very well be then a representation of the shvuas shov. So he makes these claims, and the another party says, "Mashbiocha ani." Then I want to impose upon you a shvua, an oath to that regard. The Omar, Amen, and the original speaker says, "Amen." I verify that. I verify the oath that you're imposing on me. I accept upon myself that oath. Chayav, if it turns out that he's lying, then he is in violation. What did he say after all is said and done? He said, Amen. That, nevertheless, is the equivalent of an actual oath. This is an example of mushpo mipi achirin. On the side of the Gemara, we have a nosei topic heading we call Din Shel Shmuel. Shmuel's ruling, kol ha'ina omein achar shvua, he who responds using the term omein after hearing an oath, kemoitzi shvua b'fiv, it's as if he himself uttered the oath. Ha'gemora mevi mishmei derava ha'ichachos ledin zeh mimakuros tanoim. Gemora will bring proof or support to Rava from Tanaic sources. Under the Mivneh heading, you see a triangle, and that will highlight the expression Mishmei deRava in the Gemara. You'll have Rav Papa saying in the name of Rava, and Ravino later on saying in the name of Rava, citing Tanaic sources to support Shmuel's teaching. And the dashed underline highlights the expression Masnisin Daika, the reference to the Tanaic sources that will support. And another marking, you can see Shvuas Ha'edus, we use a double underline to highlight these. Markings will have significance as we go through the Gemara. Now the Gemara. Omar Shmuel, Kol Ha'ina Omein Achar Shvua, Kemotzi Shvua Befiv Domi. He who utters the word Amen after hearing reference to an oath, after an oath is imposed, so the responder, using the word Amen, thereby obligates him or herself to that particular oath. The Rashi, lower down on the page, Kemotzi Shvobafi Mipiv Lechol Dovar, for all matters, Bein Lischayev Mishum Bitui Deboinon Sheyotzi Besvasov, whether it's a reference to a Shvuas Bitui, which he would have to otherwise utter, Bein Leinyan Shvuas Edus Demechayev Rabbi Meir Mipi Atzmo Af Shelo Bebezdin, whether it refers to the oath concerning testimony that we made reference to before, that Rebbe Meir obligates a person who initiates it on his own, even if it's outside of Beis Din. That detail we'll appreciate more when we continue into the next parak. So Shmuel says that the response of the word Amen, affirmation or acknowledgement, is the equivalent of uttering the oath itself. The source for that is Dichtiv, the Pasuk, which is found in the context of the Isha Sota. The Isha Sota is a married woman who becomes suspect of practicing immorality. There is an entire Masechta that spells out the details, and she's brought to the Beis HaMikdash, and she maintains her innocence. An oath is imposed upon her that to verify or to strengthen her claim. The Omro Ha'isha Omein Omein, and the woman, upon hearing the pronouncement of that oath, she acknowledges it. She affirms it using the term Omein. And that binds the woman by strength of a shvua to her maintenance, her claims of innocence. We have a long point now. Omar Rav Papa Mishmei de Rava. Masnisen ubraisa nami daika. Careful reading of a Mishnah and Braisa source, these two Tanaic sources, will also bear out Shmuel's point. Dikotani. Now, let me say a word about structure ahead of time. We have a frame, you can see. Generally speaking, the frame highlights a particular Tanaic source. In this case, in the middle of the frame section, you notice the expression Vitanya Bebraisa, that squiggle underline. Here, at this point in the Gemara, it will lapse into another Tanaic source that we've included in the same frame, but it's the reference to a Braisa. And at the end of the frame section, notice the Gemara itself says Kashin Adodi. The two sources appear to be contradictory. In order to resolve the contradiction, the Gemara will say, Alolav Shma Mino, Hoda Ona Omein, Hoda Lo Ona Omein. In order to resolve what appears to be a contradiction, is that in the case that Ona Omein, that Omein was recited or was stated, so then one source has relevance. With regard to the other source, it's because Omein was not said. So that with the pronouncement of Omein, you will see that it really makes a difference. Is there an oath or is there no oath on the part of the one upon whom it was imposed? Now, the Gemara itself, the Gemara text, Tikotoni, which, as Rav Papa says, the Tanaic sources, through careful reading of these sources, you will see the point made by Shmuel borne out. Shvuas ha'edus noheges banoshim v'lo banoshim. This is, in fact, the Mishnah that you see at the beginning of the next parak. It says that Shvuas ha'edus, the vow or the oath that we impose on witnesses who claim they don't know testimony, is this type of oath is noheges, is binding, is practiced, or binding banoshim, on men, on male folk, the low banoshim, not women folk. Women folk do not serve as witnesses. Berechoikim velo bekroivim. Only if the people are not related to one another, but not if they are kroven, they're related to one another. B'ksherim v'lo b'psulim. People who are acceptable to serve as witnesses in terms of their, we'll say, their piety level, and not psulim, not people that are, say, thieves. They're posel, they're disqualified because of their rishus, their sinfulness. V'eino noheges elo b'riyin lahoid, and the shvuas ha'edus is binding only with regard to those who potentially could testify or fit or qualified to testify. U'bifnei beis din v'shelo bifnei beis din mipi atzmo. It has relevance whether in the presence of the court or outside of the court if it's self-initiated, mipi atzmo. Or mipi achirim, if it's being imposed on the witnesses by others, einon chayoven at shiichburu bohen bebeis the divrei Rabbi Meir. Then it will have import if they swear the shvuas ha'edus, which means in effect they deny knowing testimony in court. So that if others are imposing the oath of testimony on witnesses, then it will have a binding effect only if it's in court. That's Rabbi Meir's approach. V'tanya b'braisa. And we have a Brisa source now, which also is taught by Rebbe Meir. If you skip to the end of this frame section, you see it says Divrei Rebbe Meir. What does Rebbe Meir say in the Brisa? Shvuos Eidus Ketzad. How is Shvuos Eidus understood or explained? How does it take place? Omar li Eidim, Boi Vaduni. Man says to witnesses, come and testify on my behalf. I believe you know information that will serve my benefit. In other words, you can testify that you saw me loan so-and-so money. And then these witnesses say, Shvua she'ein onu yoidim l'chaydus. We swear we don't know any testimony for you. Oisha Omru, or another case is, the witnesses said, Ein onu yoidim l'chaydus. When the lender claims, you know testimony for me, they responded, no, we don't know any testimony for you. And then the lender says, the tovea, he's claiming the money, he says, Mashbia ani alechem. I impose upon you an oath to substantiate that which you're saying. V'omru, amen. And they, the witnesses said, amen, we confirm that. Bein bifnei beizdin, bein shelo bifnei beizdin. And here, notice our markings. It's very important that we emphasize whether it's, as the source says, whether it's in front of Beizdin or even outside of Beizdin. Bein mi pi atzmo, bein mi pi acherim. Whether it's initiated by themselves or it's imposed by others. Kevan shikofru bohem, once they deny, and it turns out they're lying, chayovim, they are guilty. Divrei Rebbe Meir. Now, let's focus on our markings. At the end of this source, we dashed, underlined, shelo bifnei beizdin, and mipi achirim, that you can have a shvuos eidus done, imposed by others outside of court, and it could be binding. In the first half of the frame section, what did we emphasize? We have the mipi achirim, the imposed shvua. It's not chayev unless it's in Beis Din, only in Beis Din. Kashyon Ahadoti. So these two Tanaic sources, both featuring Rebbe Meir, seem to be contradictory. What's the story of a Shvua Sa'edus imposed by others outside of the court? So we can't leave you with contradictory sources. El olav shma mino ha de'ono amein. Ha de lo ona amen. The second section where we saw even shelo bifnei beizdin mipi achirim is binding, it's because they answered amen. The answering of amen makes it such that they themselves swore, as if they themselves swore. In the first section, it was imposed by others. Outside of Beis Din, they didn't say Omein. So this shows that, like Shmuel taught, that the recitation or the pronouncement of Omein, that makes it as if you actually verbalized the oath. Omar Ravina Mishmei Derava Masnisin Deochanami Daika. Careful reading of our Mishnah is also is also in accordance with Shmuel's teaching. The Katani, our Mishnah read as follows: Shvuos bitui noheges ba'anoshim uvenoshim beruchokim uvekroivim bekcherim uvepsulim b'fnei beizdin v'shelo b'fnei beizdin mipi atzmo. And now the brackets indicates an interruption of the Gemara which says as follows: in the binding element of this oath is when it's mipi atzmo, yes, it's binding. Mipi achirim, lo. Leaving you to think that if it were imposed on him by others, if the Shua's bitui was imposed by others, it would not be binding. V'katoni seifop, and as you continue reading in the Mishnah, it says, zeh v'zeh mushba mipi achirim chayav. Zeh v'zeh, the Shua's bitui, the Shua's shav, if it's imposed on him by others, he is bound. He's chayav if he violates it. Kashina dodi. So it appears that we have a contradiction. Very simply, looking at your markings, mipi acherim, according to the diuk from the resha, not bound. According to the statement of the seifa, mipi acherim, yes, bound. So we have an internal contradiction in our own Mishnah. Elo lav shma mino. Rather, we must conclude hoda ona amen. Ha de lo ona amen. If he uttered amen, so and it was stated by others, it was a vow imposed by others or an oath imposed by others, and you said amen, you acknowledged it, it's then binding. And if you didn't acknowledge it, if you didn't confirm it, it's not binding. The Gemara asks, well, after hearing the Tanaic sources seeming to be saying what they're saying then what Shmuel said. Shmuel's an Amoira. V'yela Shmuel maiko mashmolan. Then what is Shmuel telling me that I wouldn't have seen before? The Gemara answers, dukyo demasnisen ko mashmolan. The dukyo demasnisen is explained by Rashi. The second line from the bottom, dukyo demasnisen ko mashmolan ashminen didafka tnan mipi atzmo bishuas bitui avalo avol mipi achirim poter udekatoni masnisen seifa achazu veachazu mushba mipi achirim chayov de dafka beonu amen tnan. The teaching of Shmuel shows us that the resha of our Mishnah is dafka diuka tukio de masnisen, for dafka that it's specific. It's specific and precise, but it's specific to the either answering of Amen or the non-answering of Amen. So that in the Resha, the exemption of Mipi Achirim is specifically in a case where he doesn't answer Amen. In the Seifa, where Mipi Achirim results in his being Chayav, that's specifically where he said Amen. So as Rashi continues to say, that the that which he taught in the Sefer Achazu v'Achazu Mushba Mipi Achir Mischayev the Dafke Bonu Amen Tnan Kedekotoni, as it says V'Omru Amen the Lo Tema Urcha de Milsa Kotoni. What Shmuel is conveying to us is that don't think that it's only a common example Urcha de Milsa, the common way, but it's not being precise. But rather, as the Mishnah taught, at the very end, it said, "Mashpiacha ani v'omar omein." That is when he's chayev. That when you have it's a mipiachirim, and the individual responds omein. It's because of that he's chayev. So that the Mishnah is being very specific and very precise. And that's what Shmuel was telling us. And as Rashi says, understand the Mishnah thusly, and don't think that the Mishnah was just speaking as common, as mere common practice, leaving room to think that even if you don't answer Amen, that you would be bound. Not so. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to access Marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.